Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Chris Sitterick. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Newberry College becomes the latest to close its doors. We'll talk with one expert who says it's the loans to blame.
Don't lend money to students. Lend money to the colleges. If you lent money to the colleges, all the incentives would be there to correct the college financial crisis.
Also today, the latest Facebook news has users seeing red. But is giving up our personal data just part of the deal in the age of social media?
When you decide that you are no longer going to give away your data, your photos, your videos, and practically every place that you go, until that day comes, you're giving away something about you.
And children's author and illustrator Jan Brett says writing her books helps her recapture the magic of childhood.
I feel like I'm tapping into that wonderful feeling when you're exploring the world and discovering things and your imagination has no borders.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sitterick. Newberry College will close at the end of the academic year. It becomes the second Massachusetts college to close in 2018, and the third if you include Wheelock College's merger with Boston University. And Bob Hildreth says that student loans are to blame. He's the founder of the Hildreth Institute and Inversent, two nonprofit organizations that help get low-income students to college. And he argues that because student loans are essentially free money for colleges, that it's created a financial model built on the assumption that schools can continue to raise tuition and students will be willing to take on more and more debt to pay for it. And according to Bob, that approach has left colleges with empty seats and resulted in the closure of schools like Newberry College. Hildreth says the only path forward for institutions of higher ed is to end the reliance on student loans. And he joins us now in studio. Bob Hildreth, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, Chris.
And I should say, Bob, that you're funding a lawsuit against Mount Ida College and its former overseers, and also that you're a member of the WBUR Board of Overseers and a key financial contributor to WBUR's expanded education coverage. Just want to get that out of the way at the top.
Wow.
I know, a mouthful, right? So you say that basically Newberry's college reliance on student debt played a huge role in its failure. Why is that?
Well, the first thing we have to look at is that for 2 years in a row, Forbes has given Newberry College a D. Two D's in a row. So we knew something was wrong. What was really wrong is they couldn't maintain their pricing. They kept discounting deeper and deeper their listed pricing until they weren't bringing enough in. It's similar to airplane company that puts a discount on every single flyer in a plane until finally the flight doesn't make any money.
Right. So trying to fill the seats, basically.
Trying to fill the seats. And that's what Newberry was trying to do, fill the seats. They got into a lot of bad behavior because of student loans. The first thing that you might say in general is that student loans have caused colleges to double in size, in number, since 1965. And what are the colleges that have been doubling? They're colleges that act on the margin. One type of college that is most notable is for-profit colleges. So here you have a college, they're nicknamed Stafford Factories, which Stafford is the name of the government loan.
Federal loan, right.
So the only reason why they're in existence financially is to get the proceeds from the Stafford loans. This is a little bit counterintuitive because since 1965, colleges have gotten free money of $1.5 trillion. So you might say, what's the problem? But it's a little bit like somebody who gets too much money when they win the lottery. Bad behavior happens.
But it's a little bit of a catch-22. You do a lot of work trying to get increased access for low-income students to colleges. You know, some would say those programs were created to make exactly that happen, to make a college more affordable for folks.
Yes, you mean the programs of Inversant that we match what people save for college.
Right. I'm talking about loans, though. The increase of availability of loans was an attempt to kind of make college more accessible.
Exactly. Up until 1965, only white males went to our colleges. And President Johnson, precisely because he wanted to make colleges more accessible, he created student loans. But perversely, they've acted the wrong way. The basic problem is they broke the cardinal rule of lending, which says that if you get the proceeds from a loan, you have to repay it. In this Alice in Wonderland world, colleges get the proceeds from the loan, but have to repay nothing. So if you're sitting there at the board and say, I wonder if I should raise tuition, and you say, well, 50% of it is just going to come from a wire direct into us from the government, why not? Raise tuition. Let's see what happens. And they do it year after year after year. In fact, very suspiciously, because of student loans, colleges raise, the top 150 colleges raise tuition by 3.5%. Kind of sounds like an oligopoly.
Yeah. So, okay, if federally issued student loans are the root of the problem, what's the solution?
The solution is, let me just step back and say, when we say student loan, we should really say teenager loan. We give loans to 17, 18-year-olds who, by law, could not get a loan from a bank unless they got a co-sign for the parent. And then we dump $32,000 on them. So guess what? They're not repaying. The government will only get out of the $1.5 trillion, they'll only get about half repaid. So what can we do about it? We rotate from student loans to college loans. Long-term, easy-rate loans directly held by colleges so that now they have good behavior. We show them some tough love. We say, if you want this money, eventually you're going to have to pay it back. So maybe you'll think, wait a second, if I raise tuition, then I'm going to have to take out more of a loan. Do I want to do that? No. Tuitions would come down, Chris.
So what about schools like Harvard or the wealthier schools that don't necessarily need those loans? Wouldn't they then have an incentive not to take students that would need financial aid?
Well, Harvard is in a realm of its own. But
sure. But there are
let me address the question directly. The nice thing of switching into colleges is it gives the government a tool. Now they can say to colleges, if you have diverse students or low-income students above the average, we're going to forgive some of your loan. You can start to manipulate this whole thing. Now, some people would say, oh, don't let the government in. But if the government on average is already accounting for 40 to 50% of any college's tuition, they're in already.
But couldn't that increase the gap if you have these wealthier schools that say, well, I don't want the government to have that kind of leverage over us, so we're only going to take students that can pay the tuition either cash or through their own financial situation rather than need the government assistance?
We have a situation now that's very similar. In other words, while BU would have to take 25% of its tuition from the government, Harvard would take 5%.
Right.
So it's already there. But that kind of thing wouldn't change. But you could use this as a way to get more low-income students into every college in America.
So I also think that this is a pretty complicated issue. I agree with you that we're kind of at a breaking point because even the students that do end up graduating and paying back their debt, they basically have a mortgage without even having a house when they get out of college. But I've seen research that's kind of all over the map on this in terms of what's driving the cost increase. For example, in July, Richard Vedder, an author, a well-known professor of economics emeritus at Ohio University, told Business Insider while there's a connection between availability of financial aid and higher tuition, that according to his research, the ultimate cause of cost increase has been just basically the number of people looking for a college education. How are you so sure that it's the loans themselves that are the main factor driving up cost?
Because of the data. Tuition was flat all the way up to the creation of student loans. Harvard in 1970 was $4,000. Harvard in 1980, 10 years later, was $4,000. Then in 1965, a straight line up of tuition. So is that just coincidence when that was the biggest thing that changed? In general, economists will tell you that expenditures will rise to the level of revenues available. You can see it in your own life. If all of a sudden I gave you enough money to buy a Mercedes-Benz, then you, instead of that Toyota, you might buy it.
So I think there's also an issue of investment that has been going down pretty consistently overall for state funding. And this is granted just for public schools, but that's a big part of the system. Public schools for 2 and 4 year colleges in the school year ending in 2018 was more than $7 billion lower than funding levels 10 years ago, 2008. So how does that decrease in public investment play into the equation
okay.
here?
Where it plays in the equation is states are no fools. They saw that if they if students were getting all this money from loans, why should they keep up the levels of funding for their colleges? I was talking to – whenever I talk to politicians, I say, does any parent call you and complain about the level of their loans? No. So they had a free – this is so perverse. What's happened is college funding has switched from the state to the federal government through student loans. But ultimately, it's flowed right to the parents, right to the home.
So then why isn't bringing more state funding back in part of the solution?
It is. It's a very big part.
So
for public schools,
I
am very much in favor of that. The only thing is I don't know if be enough. So I also want to give them access to concessionary loans above what they'll get from these state governments.
I'm curious your thoughts about the Newberry College example specifically. There's some troubling stories of Newberry recruiting actual students from Mount Ida. What's your thought on how the school kind of handled their whole situation?
Remember that schools are not companies. They're 501c3s. We give them billions of dollars of tax-free revenues in order that they have a higher standard of performance. Newberry knew. I mean, remember I said that they got 2 D's in a row? They knew they were going down the tubes when they accepted those Mount Ida students. There should have been, I think, instead of these arguments, don't reveal your cards. Uh-uh. You're a 501c3. Reveal your cards.
Well, and the federal government does issue scores for the financial situations at schools, and both Newberry and Mount Ida were not in the danger zone. So I guess there's a question of how do you make sure that we have all the information we need?
Okay. That is a very important question. And the answer to that is we don't have the information that we need. Part of it is due to the complexity. For instance, there are 57 different kinds of student loan repayment plans. 57, same as Heinz.
the ketchup.
Ketchup, yeah. So we don't have the information we need, but we also have the government, who, because they now have $1.5 trillion out there, they don't want this program to fail. They will do anything to keep the knowledge. The biggest way they keep the knowledge about the truth on student loans is if you're a bank and they lend to Chris and Chris doesn't repay, you have to put that loan on reserve. The government doesn't.
So there's a lot of folks that would say we're kind of at the edge of the cliff here, and, yes, and that basically the system is at a breaking point. If you ask these schools who are just scraping by as it is to pick up debt now from government loans to fill in the gaps, couldn't that be the nail in the coffin for a lot of schools?
Remember I said tough love. First, these schools are going to close anyway, and I don't want them to close where the last people will hear about them, the students. We have to.
Does that mean we're seeing the end of kind of the small liberal arts college? Is that
no? But we're seeing the end of the doubling from 4,000 to 2,000.
So the market's saturated.
It's
basically
definitely true. The market is saturated. This will be bad news for for-profits. no doubt about it. There will be school closures. And so it's going to have to be negotiated. The loan that we give to colleges is going to have to be similar to the loan that you give to defaulted countries. It's going to have to be very long term, very low interest rate, so that maybe inflation will eat up all the costs of the loan. You would say, well, isn't that a bad deal for the government? The government right now on student loans is stuck in a terrible deal.
Is it time, though, to start looking at higher education differently in terms of the model? A lot of schools have spent so much money on facilities trying to recruit students. I'm looking at some schools that have expanded their online programs. A lot of people are really interested in doing online degrees. Is it time to rethink how we see college?
Absolutely. Look at Newman College for a second. You might have seen the Boston Globe article today where everybody's hungering after the land in Brookline. Well, where did they get the money to buy that land? Probably, because money is fungible, from student loans. That money, when it comes into a college, can be used for anything. So the model will change radically if the colleges are responsible for the money we give them.
So you think there's still a place in the future of the higher education sphere for small liberal arts schools to have a campus and an on-campus program?
I think it will be increasingly tough. Remember, University of Toronto is, I think, the largest colleges in North America. Europe has very large colleges, but alumni can keep their colleges open if they give endowments. That's the only way in the future. Keep giving to your college.
We're definitely going to have to figure this out because there's a whole generation of students that are grappling with this right now. Well, that's Bob Hildreth. He's the founder of the Hildreth Institute, Inversant, and La Vida Scholars, nonprofit organizations that help get low-income students to college. He's also funding a lawsuit against Mount Ida College and its former overseers. And he's a member of the WBUR Board of Overseers and a key financial contributor to WBUR's expanded education coverage. Bob, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thanks so much, Chris.
Stay with us. Coming up, is it time to finally say goodbye to Facebook? I'm Chris Sidorek. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sidorek. This week, we learned through a New York Times investigation that Facebook is collecting and sharing even more data than many users knew about. In fact, they found Facebook gave Microsoft's Bing search engine access to the names of virtually all Facebook users' friends without consent, and also gave Netflix and Spotify access to users' private messages. Overall, more than 150 companies had more access to people's data than Facebook had disclosed. Joining me now to take a closer look at how Facebook has used our data is Hiawatha Bray, technology reporter for the Boston Globe. Hiawatha, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And also with us is Al Tompkins, senior faculty and group leader for broadcast media at the Poynter Institute. Thanks for joining us, Al.
What a story for Facebook in 2018, huh?
Yeah, to cap it all off, definitely. And listeners, I know that I've been struggling with this dilemma. I'm sure many of you have too. Have you thought about quitting Facebook? Have you already quit Facebook? Or is this just all part of the deal when we willingly share so much of ourselves online? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. So Hiawatha, I want to start with you. Before we get into the news of this week, let's do a quick roundup of 2018. As Al kind of implied there, it's been quite a year for Facebook. Remind us of some of the major stories that we saw over the past year.
You know, I had to go look some of this stuff up because it's gotten to the point where there are so many that they all blur. I mean, you, of course, started out with the continuing hangover from the 2016 election where people found out about just how much was done by Russia using Facebook and other social media companies to try to influence the vote. Well, basically, they didn't do much of anything. One issue that didn't get nearly as much attention here in the U.S. is the whole issue of the Rohingya Muslims in Myanmar, where apparently a lot of hate messages that stirred up rage and led to, in some cases, mass murders of Muslims in Myanmar was transmitted over Facebook. Because they did not filter out misinformation, and they did not filter out speech that was basically calling for violence against these people. That was something that didn't get a lot of attention here in the U.S., but was a really huge issue. And, of course, you had Cambridge Analytica with the whole thing with the sharing of 87 million Facebook profiles with a company that wanted to use the information to help the election of Donald Trump. By the way, in all fairness, I think there's kind of a lot of hypocrisy going on around the whole Cambridge Analytica thing. Because 4 years earlier, when they were sharing that kind of information with the Obama administration, and they were, the Obama campaign got access to huge amounts of personal information from Facebook. And people were actually talking about what a brilliant thing it was that they were using it that way instead of saying, hey, wait a minute, what about people's privacy? So this was not a new thing, and the backlash against this has a certain amount of hypocrisy in it, I think.
Well, and you mentioned Cambridge Analytica. That does kind of catch us up to the news of the week, because just yesterday, the Attorney General in the District of Columbia filed a lawsuit against Facebook for their entanglement with Cambridge Analytica. And then you also had the New York Times report. If you can just kind of highlight the major takeaways from the New York Times reporting this week.
Well, the major takeaway from the New York Times report is, in some ways, it to me is one of the scariest things of all, because so many of us in America feel as though we're living in a world dominated by corporate giants who simply do not care about the interests of ordinary people. And so much of what we're seeing here seems to highlight the idea that there's something to that image. These guys were giving out sensitive personal information to their quote-unquote business partners and allies, who turn out to be companies like Microsoft and Amazon and Netflix and Spotify. And they were sharing much more granular information about what we were doing on Facebook and what our friends were doing on Facebook than any of us ever realized. And a lot of, you look at this and you sit there going, what else aren't they telling us? Time and again, that's the big issue with a lot of these Facebook revelations. Time and again, what really bothers me isn't just the revelation itself. It's the realization that there's a whole world of information abuse going on out there that we know nothing about, because the people who run these companies, Facebook, Google, and others, don't have to be accountable.
Yeah, the lack of oversight, I think, is maybe
the
most
disturbing
thing. We
have no idea what they're doing, and we have no way to know.
Yeah, so Al, I want to bring you in here. The thing that jumped out at me from all the reporting was the fact that some of these companies like Netflix and Spotify have the ability to read, delete our personal messages, and see everyone who's included in conversation chains. That seems to me like way over the line, but I'm afraid you're going to tell me that's my fault for being on Facebook at all, right?
Well, I wouldn't say it's fault. It's just what we do now, right?
Right.
This year has been bookend from February when, I mean, we don't even remember that the Robert Mueller investigation indicted a bunch of Russian trolls, later indicted a bunch of Iranian trolls posing as Americans and British. And those just get kind of lost in the ether, and because there's probably no chance we're ever going to see any resolution to those cases. And that's part of the problem, is that we are in a global internet-connected society where it's very difficult, even if you did have the Federal Trade Commission or somebody else trying to do something about security in the United States. It's still a global connectivity that that makes the internet work, and that's where our vulnerabilities lie.
All right.
Go ahead. I would say also, though, as users, to your question, as users, one of our great vulnerabilities that we probably don't realize is that we don't just use Facebook to post photos and connect with friends. We also often use Facebook is a way to sign on to an app. So we give the app permission to use our Facebook account. And so we shouldn't be surprised when we find out, as we have this year, that they've given apps, and possibly 1,500 or more apps have had access not just to our sign-in information, but even to photographs.
Yeah, and a lot of these companies...
And to our friends.
A lot of these companies, too, have said they didn't even realize they had all of the access they had, and it went way beyond what they actually needed to offer the products and services they were offering.
That is a very good point. I don't know if they're telling the truth or not. They might actually be, because it highlights the ultimate carelessness with which a lot of this is being done. I wouldn't be surprised if some of these companies said, oh, do we have that? I didn't realize. It was like the time Google was trying to design a mapping system, and they were using people's Wi-Fi signals to try to generate radio maps of the area, and they captured millions of people's emails, and they said, oops, we didn't realize.
Here's an interesting one. You know, there was an app called Pikini. You probably haven't heard of it, but there was a company called 643 that developed this app called Pikini.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can use Pikini to search Facebook to find people in their bathing suits. The whole idea is to find bikini pictures of people.
Unbelievable. Yeah. I want to bring some callers in on the conversation as well. We've got Sam from Brighton on the line. Sam, welcome to Radio Boston. What's on your mind?
Hi. Just talking about information security and the present day, and I don't think that when we put this information out there, it stops being ours in any meaningful sense. Like, and we need to reckon with that as a society, right? Like that we don't, when we create this information, we give it to some company that then it's out there. That like information security, that privacy in a meaningful sense isn't going to exist moving forward. So like, what? How are we going to start thinking about our privacy moving forward?
So Sam, I'm curious. Are you on Facebook? Do you have a Facebook account?
Yeah, and like everyone in my generation does.
Yeah,
or something like it.
Like right.
Everyone's we're gonna have to use some social media platform.
So as a user, does this kind of stuff disturb you, or do you think this is just part of the territory of sharing online?
I mean, it's disturbing, but it's nothing shocking anymore.
Right.
Like, because you see where it's all going.
Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, I want to be careful about this because I hear what you're saying. But, for example, there was nothing inherent in the nature of Facebook that requires that they share that information with Amazon or Spotify. That was a business decision. It's one thing to say, well, you're giving this information to Facebook. What do you expect? Yeah, that's fair enough. But it isn't necessarily clear to the average user that when you're giving it to Facebook, you're giving it to 100 other giant corporations. And I think it's unfair to assume that we should assume that.
So
why should they be able to do that?
Yeah, I think that's
clearly getting our permission.
I think that's a great point, Hiawatha. And I want to actually ask you about some congressional testimony that Mark Zuckerberg gave back in April.
I don't remember all of it.
I know. I'm going to play it for you. Don't worry. So this is responding to a question from Congressman Greg Walden from Oregon about whether or not Facebook actually sells user data.
There is a common misperception, as you say, that is just reported, often keeps on being reported, that for some reason we sell data. I can't be clearer on this topic. We don't sell data. That's not how advertising works. And I do think we could probably be doing a clearer job explaining that given the misperceptions that are out there.
So technically they don't sell data, but what they do is share data, and it's dependent on their relationship with their different partners.
Exactly.
So are we just playing semantics there?
I mean, it does matter, I suppose, in some sense. They're not directly selling the data. They are striking business alliances with other companies that benefit from getting access to this data, but no actual money directly changes hands for the data itself. Instead, however, for example, you have a relationship with, say, Microsoft, and being connected with Microsoft helps route more eyeballs back toward Facebook, and that's how they're paid.
Al, what's your take on it?
Well, look, your listeners only have to share this experience, which I'm sure they all share with me. 2 days ago, I was thinking about buying a sweater. I'm in Florida, and we have 2 days of sweater weather here.
I know where this is going.
So I was thinking about buying a sweater, and then I backed out, reasoning, in 48 hours, I'm not going to need it anymore. And yet, this morning, I'm still getting ads on Facebook from the very company that I shopped online but backed out of. So they are, in fact, giving access to people who know where I am. You'll also, in the next few weeks, if you haven't already, be getting a little display on your Facebook page that will recap your last year. And they'll give you a whole collage with music and everything of the highlights of your year, featuring all the photographs and videos you've posted this year. On the one hand, I thought, well, that's cool. That'll save me from even thinking about it. On the other hand, I thought, that's really creepy. They've been keeping up with every single thing I've been doing this year. They know where I've been, what I've done, and in fact, they produced it into a video for me.
Well,
so
now,
on the one hand,
fair.
We get convenience.
That's one of those moments where it does make sense to say, hey, you told them all that.
So
you're
right.
Hard to complain about that.
So and that
exactly
is kind of
right.
that's I think the frustrating thing is that there are some really great things that I enjoy about being on Facebook. I get to share pictures of my kid with my family who may or may not live close to me. I can connect with people that I probably wouldn't be texting or calling on a daily basis, but maybe it's easier to shoot a comment or post something after they do an update. And so there are real draws there, and I think it's interesting when you look at the net that Facebook has built, because it's not just Facebook anymore. You've also got Instagram, you've got WhatsApp. They're all kind of part of the Facebook network, and I think it can be really tough for people to walk away from that because they're so entrenched in it. Was that part of Facebook's model in bringing in users and making sure they stay?
Oh, absolutely. Well, don't forget. Things like you mentioned the whole thing about how increasingly, and this has been going on for years, there are many online services where you sign in by logging on through Facebook. And by the way, also
I never
Google,
do that,
they
by
do
the way.
Same thing. Oh, me too. Absolutely not. I will not do it.
Absolutely.
Because you know that all you're doing is giving more data to Facebook.
Right.
But of course, you can't necessarily avoid that even, because Facebook has relationships with something like a million different websites where they put little cookies on the website. If you go there, just your going there tells Facebook you were there. Even if you don't realize it, you go to this website, Facebook now knows you went there.
All right, so
Don't forget how much we all benefit from Facebook, though.
Tell me about it.
Companies get millions and millions of connections just by what they publish, and virtually every person listening here has some benefit from Facebook doing what it does, because
you hear about things, you
attend things, your businesses, media companies publish. And so it is a trade-off. And at some point, the tipping point will occur where we'll say, you know what, I'm not going to give up anymore. But
are we there? Is this the tipping point? I mean, this is, again, another troubling story in a year of troubling stories for Facebook.
If the Russians hacking the election wasn't enough, I don't know where the tipping point is. If the Russians trolling Facebook isn't enough, you know, what's going to scare you? Cambridge Analytica? Nobody knows what that is. I mean, they just don't get it. Until it shows up on your credit account, until it costs you money or some inconvenience,
right.
I don't think so.
I have a confession to make. The Russia thing didn't scare me all that much. Personally, I think so they're advertising on Facebook. I'm not really sure why that's supposed to terrify me that much, except I don't like the fact that we didn't know it was them. As far as I'm concerned, I don't care what ads. They should just have to put it on the bottom. You know, I'm Vladimir Putin, and I approve this message. And if they did that, I wouldn't even care. But I did want to speak to your part about how useful Facebook is, because I have a story about it in the Globe, about how there are scientists at Tufts and MIT who have tried to calculate this. And they've done surveys and found that the average person says you'd have to give them $1,000 a year to get them to stop using Facebook for 1 year. And that, if you took that across the entire membership of Facebook, that works out to the world is basically saying Facebook is worth $2 trillion a year to us in usefulness.
I want to go back to the phones real quick, because Brian from Newton, I think, has a great question for you guys. I'm hoping you might have an answer for us. Brian, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me. This is a great conversation, because you're right. It is terrifying. I'm wondering if your guests have any recommendations for companies who actually care about your privacy. Are there any big technology companies out there who are going to protect your data?
Well, it's hard to know. I mean, the best known of the search services that vow never to track you is DuckDuckGo. That's duck, you know, like quack quack. And they insist that they never collect data on the people who use them. And there are also a variety of companies that offer locked down private to email services. I mean, for example, just about any service where you pay for email and it's not being used to advertise to you is probably going to give you more privacy than a service like Gmail or Yahoo Mail or somebody like that. But you have to take these companies' words for it. That's the other important thing. When they tell you we're protecting your privacy, how do you know for sure that they aren't?
Bit like standing in the rain with a leaky umbrella, though. I mean, on the one hand, you think you're being protected. On the other hand, you're getting wet. All it takes is just a tiny crack, and your data goes leaking out. So that's the trouble. I mean, the problem is that there any one solution is not going to protect everything you're doing. And by the way, don't forget, you can be as careful as you want. Share something or let Hiawatha tag you in one of his posts, and guess what? You're public again.
Well, there's also the problem, too, if we're looking for other platforms, everybody's on Facebook already, and if you want to have all these connections and these places to share things, you need everybody to come with you to make it as effective, right?
Absolutely. It's a huge problem. And on top of all that, to move away from Facebook for a second, let's not forget what, to me, was one of the most outrageous recent data thefts, and that was the Equifax scandal, where they broke in and cleaned out Equifax. Basically, something like half of the population of the United States had their personal information stolen. Now, Equifax is a data broker. They collect information about you, and you don't have any say over it. They just go get it and put it in a central location where somebody can steal it. So, you know, it's not just Facebook. There are all these companies out here compiling data over which we have almost no control.
So I'm curious, you talked earlier, Hiawatha, about the lack of oversight and regulation. Part of that comes from the fact that Facebook is classified as a tech company as opposed to a media company. Is reclassifying Facebook a possibility? Could that potentially be a way to increase oversight?
It's conceivable. I mean, what scares me about this problem is that every solution seems to me to be almost as scary, if not scarier, than the problem itself. Government regulation of Facebook. See, one of the things that makes Facebook scary is that they have more information about us than even any government has ever collected. So now we're going to take it and give it to the government. Oh, yeah, that'll help. That'll make me feel really secure. The closest thing to a secure solution I've heard of is the idea of maybe just breaking them up. But I'm not even sure that would help, because they'd still have the information they've already collected, and the individual pieces would still be out there collecting information. It's like, you know, cutting off the head of the Hydra and two more grow in its place. I'm just not sure what you do about it.
Al, what do you think?
The Federal Trade Commission cannot keep people from calling me at dinner time, much less regulate the Internet.
Thank you.
All right, on that note, we can leave it there, I think. That's Hiawatha Bray, technology reporter for the Boston Globe. Hiawatha, thanks as always for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
And Al Tompkins, senior faculty and group leader for broadcast media at the Poynter Institute. Al, thanks for your time and insight.
You bet.
Stay with us. Coming up, children's author and illustrator Jan Brett on how she captures the magic of childhood in writing her books. I'm Chris Siderick. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Chris Siderick. As you age, you naturally discover that your body can't handle all the same stresses the way it used to. But new research shows people can push themselves and benefit from more from exercise, even as they slow down with age. WBUR's Kyrie Thompson explains.
Have you ever heard the saying, "Father Time is undefeated"? 70-year-old runner Mike Ferrullo of Boston probably has. Ferrullo started running 40 years ago to overcome drug addiction.
If you want to survive and keep running, you have to first accept that you're not 35, 40 anymore. And your mind might want to run like that, but your running regimen has to be different.
Following that advice has paid off for Ferrullo, who plans to run until he's 80. And as the president of the Boston Bulldogs Running Club, he's helping others push themselves into their later years. One of his runners is 57-year-old Alice Rushforth. She's also the executive director of the Tufts Clinical and Translational Sciences Institute. Rushforth didn't start taking running more seriously until her 50s. With her 60s approaching, she thinks there's still time to go faster in the future.
Now, to keep working at it and to have those goals and to get a little excited about my performance, I'm finding that I'm working hard to beat the time from last year or 5 years ago. And I can say, here I am. I'm 3-4 years older, and I'm actually doing that 5K faster.
New research offers more hope for runners like Ferrullo and Rushforth, who want to thrive later in life. An October study in the Review of Economics and Statistics compares world record times of runners ages 40 to 95 to estimate how much people slow down with age in races like the marathon and the 5K. Its data show older runners only decline gradually after age 40 before finally slowing down more dramatically in their late 70s. Also, study models predict people slow down at about the same rate each year, whether they're elite runners or not. Ed Kaplan is a professor of engineering and public health at Yale and is one of the study's authors. He says, as long as you're meeting your personal goals as a runner, that's all that matters.
It's as if you were running a longer race. The people at the leading edge of it, those are the world record holders, the people who were further back in the pack are further back in the pack. But nonetheless, this idea that they're going down a couple percentage points a year is something which actually seems to hold.
And with runners like 70-year-old Jeannie Rice of Cleveland setting marathon world records for her age group, the authors also wanted to answer another question. How fast can a 70-year-old marathoner possibly run? The study compares today's fastest runners to its own predictions for the fastest humanly possible time for each age and type of distance race. The authors also suggest that these fastest possible times may decrease in the future as more older people run with improved training practices and nutrition. That's why Kaplan says elderly runners 10 years from now could leave today's record holders in the dust.
We estimate that you could knock off about 7.5% of the existing time. So, for example, with the marathon, that says that we believe it will be humanly possible to cut maybe another 9 and 9.5 minutes off of the marathon.
The models in the study assume runners stay in shape and avoid major injuries that might slow them down more than expected. You may need to adjust your expectations for your own running, depending on how those factors affect you. Furthermore, there's not much data on women and how they slow down with age. Rushforth says having more information on women runners would further motivate her to keep improving.
All the information that's online now in these kinds of studies is important. It's not the kind of thing that I tapped into for motivation in my youth, but now I do look up my times compared to other women my age and use that as a little bit of an incentive.
Motivation.
And I do the...
I look up to Alice's.
No.
I think
how's that it's getting better.
That's funny. Yeah. I'm just the opposite.
Future research will focus on gathering more data on 80- and 90-year-old runners, as runners at those ages are less common. But whether you're a dedicated athlete or just looking to exercise more, don't just assume that you're too old to lace up your shoes and get a run in.
That report from WBUR's Kyrie Thompson. All right, I'll admit it. I'm really excited to talk with our next guest because she's kind of a big deal in our house. I'm speaking for myself and also for my 3-year-old son, Evan, who has fallen in love with Norwell, Massachusetts author Jam Brett's work. Here he is talking about all of the kittens he can see on a page from one of our favorites, Annie and the Wild Animals.
They're everywhere. They're everywhere, like here. They're everywhere.
And clearly, we're not alone because she's a children's author and illustrator with more than 41 million books in print. Jan Brett's new book is called The Snowy Nap, and she joins us now in the studio. Jan Brett, welcome to Radio Boston.
Oh, thank you. What a great introduction. Because, I mean, it's all about kids.
Well, as I said, you are much beloved in our household. So your stories are great, but really it's your illustrations, I think, that make your books come to life. You have this very distinctive style. It's warm and rustic and comforting. When my executive producer showed me this book, I knew it was you without even seeing your name, just by the style of the illustration on the cover. I'm wondering, how did you develop or find that, or did it just kind of come naturally?
Well, ever since I was in kindergarten, I wanted to be a children's book illustrator. And I don't know whether it was because I was shy and I was a slow thinker. Things didn't always come out right. Had a piece of paper in front of me. I could just think about what I wanted to put on there. And for some reason, I've just never been able to forget that feeling. It got to be a way of communicating. And I love details in the books that I was read to a lot when I was little. And I loved Beatrix Potter, and I loved reading about other countries that would describe things like wainscoting or John the Joiner. And I didn't know what that meant, but you could tell by the way that she described it in the pictures what it really was. And I felt like I was getting so much information. I loved that. You know how children are.
Oh, yeah.
The more you can discover about the world, the happier you are. So I just decided that's the kind of illustrator I want to be. And now I always think of, you know, people have muses. You know. So this is, I'm not totally serious about this, but I always think about my 6-year-old self. What would she have said?
Love that image. And so it's interesting. You are an illustrator first and then kind of an author.
Absolutely,
in
yeah.
response to that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you've written so many books at this point. I think you and I were just chatting off the air. You said probably more than 40. I would guess The Mitten is probably your most well-known.
It is. The Mitten is the now my strive to have another Mitten book that's similar. Just because it's just so gratifying to have people say that's such an important part of my life.
Do you have a favorite that you've written over the years, or is that
I love Berlioz the Bear because it's my husband Joe playing the double bass, and I had to make him into a bear, cover him with fur.
Nice.
And yet all body language is the same, and it's the Boston Symphony, so he plays in the Boston Symphony. So that part was fun. And I love the hat because my daughter is in this. And now the new one is my granddaughter. She is the character. But it's always the book I'm working on because that's the one I'm
– You're invested in.
You know, I always think, is this one going to be better than the last one? And so I just have my hopes up, and then there'll be the period when it first comes out, and there's always a big deadline. And, oh, this is the worst book I've ever done. Oh, this is terrible. And then after about a year, I'll go, oh, I'll never do as good as that book.
It's a real roller coaster.
Yeah.
A lot of your illustrations, it features not just the image of what's happening on the page in the story, but along the borders or on the sides, there might be something that's foreshadowing something that's coming or depicting another character, what they're doing at that moment. Is that multi-layered approach something that you specifically do for kids because you want to have more for them to look at, or was it just kind of a natural as you're drawing the image, that's what it's
like? Yeah, that's so perceptive of you to notice that. Well, I think what it is it's natural, but I love to see, I think of children as being these incredibly intelligent beings that are somewhat limited because of experience and because of their vocabulary, but that they understand nuance, they can understand irony, black humor, all these things that just, that's the way they are. They're so absorbent. And so it makes me really happy to think that they can look at all these little details that I put in and understand I'm trying to be funny but it's not about words. It's just the pictures. And I love it when they get their pointer fingers out. They go around the page. Because if you think about it, a children's book is that one communication where they can decide when they're going to turn the page. They can have control about it. And I was like that with my books. I might read a page like 10 times. Yeah. Or, you know, the parent always reads the same book like 10 times. And so
that totally happens
really happy.
When we're reading your books at home. There'll be a page and I'll go to turn the page and Evan says, no, I'm not done yet, and wants to kind of look at things and talk about them. There's just such a sense of joy kind of hearing that imagination in a child's voice. So I have one more cut of my son I want to play, and then that's it, I promise, no more. But he is talking about one of the pictures, and you can hear him kind of imagining. Again, this is from Annie and the Wild Animals.
That's the snarling wildcat.
No, this is it, licking his tongue.
Uh-huh.
Not this one. That's a new one hiding behind trees. Maybe he's called a hiding tree guy.
Maybe.
Because he hides behind the tree.
So I don't know if the character's name was Hiding Tree Guy, but I would suggest that for your next book. But
I love it. I mean, that's the thing is when I just came back from a book tour across the country, and the kids come up with the most they have the most amazing imaginations. So what happens? So I think we just all have to encourage the children to, you know, write their own stories, draw their own pictures, and not be too limited about, you know, what they can and cannot draw, because you never know what their perspective is. It's amazing.
Yeah. One of the things I think that makes your book such a hit with kids and with teachers and parents is that even on your website, you have all these kind of supplementary materials, activity pages, coloring pages. One of my favorites, I'm thinking of the mitten, where you can make the mitten, and then you have all these animals that you can cut out and color. And as you go through the book, they go into the mitten, and then, spoiler alert, everybody, the bear sneezes, the animals go everywhere, and the kid gets to dump them out and stuff. Are those activities and kind of additional materials, do you think about those as you're writing, or those afterwards? How do you craft those?
Oh, it's afterwards. Afterwards. Because it's like creating a world. And a lot of times when I speak to young children and they're talking about all these characters that they have in this world they occupy and all these like little rules of this special planet they're in or this time or place that they're in, oh, yeah, that one's going to be an illustrator because it is creating a world. And then it's almost like a bubble. It's very hard to come out of it and then all of a sudden be, you know, go to the store.
Back to the real world.
Yeah,
right?
Go back to the real world. So maybe that's part of it, is being able to kind of erase that border between real and unreal.
I love that idea. So speaking of the real world, in our current day and age, there are so many distractions for kids, TV, tablets, smartphones, toys and games that have all kinds of electronic lights and sounds. Do you think it's become harder to get kids to actually sit down and read?
Well, not necessarily because of teachers, because all the kids go to school and they have to learn to read, and so the teachers know the best way to teach a child to read is to give them a book, and then so they're just amazing. The teachers will have, you know, a book for every child. It's almost like a pride for them is to be able to pick the perfect book for that. Perfect for that child, yeah. Especially if the child isn't learning to read, maybe something that's simpler, but maybe the illustrations are more up to their level. They just don't have the vocabulary so that they can, you know, choose between different books. And it's an art. It's really an art. The teachers are incredible, and librarians, and librarians too.
So you've been doing this a long time. I'm curious, has anything in your approach kind of changed or evolved over the years?
Has anything changed? No, I don't think anything really has changed. It's always the same. It's just always exciting. It's what I think the most amazing thing, and I've heard adult authors say this too, is you get into like this world when you're drawing where time just stands still and you become, it's almost like it takes you on a ride. And that is so exciting when that happens. And I encourage children to do this when they're drawing, is to just kind of let go and get into your drawing. So it's almost like something human beings can do that we should really nurture and cherish. And it's, I hate to use the word magical, but it's a phenomenon.
There's nothing wrong with the word magical.
It's a phenomenon that happens. Sometimes you don't even know what the end is going to be to the story. But I'll get up in the morning and look at what I've done the night before, and it's like elves were there. I don't even remember doing it.
Perfect transition. Speaking of elves, we're well into the Christmas season here. Any recommendations other than the snowy nap, obviously, for folks who might still be looking for a gift for a child in their life?
Well, my grandchildren love Goodnight Construction Site.
It's a big hit at our house, too.
Yeah, isn't that cute? It's just great. They all think, because I can't draw trucks. So I just like to say, this is the great book. Anything by Tommy DiPaola. He's also a wonderful colleague and a fantastic artist.
Well, that's Norwell-based children's author and illustrator Jan Brett. Her new book is The Snowy Nap. There's more information about it at our website, radioboston.org. Jan, thank you so much for coming in today.
Oh, you're so welcome.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Paris Alston, Zoe Mitchell, and Eve Zuckoff. Tim Skog is our technical director, and our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. We had engineering help today from Renee Marchand. I'm Chris Siddick. Join us tomorrow for more Radio Boston.